I saw one come in majesty and awe, and on his head were crowns of victory. Our first great father's spirit, Adam, he withdrew from the crypt. And righteous Abel and Noah, who had built the ark, Moses, King David, Abraham, Rachel, Eve, with many others of his chosen nation. These did he bless, and know that ere that day, no human soul had ever seen salvation from this place. Now, do you know when that happened?
When Christ saw it.
Yes.
He
descended into hell. For 3 days, he descended into hell. Okay, now, he descended into hell when? When he let his heart break and dropped the sword. So you see how consistent this iconography is? If you really want to liberate the lost life trapped in the unconscious, trapped in hell, there's only one way to get there. You have to let your heart break. You have to go into your feelings. You have to, because, yes.
It's an experience of death, right?
Yeah.
Death
to life as you know.
Death to life as you know, and that's right. It's the only way in is through a kind of death.
Jung stood up at the Analytical Psychology Club in New York in 1936 and made some off-the-cuff comments. You can find these in Trauma and the Soul. And he said to the assembled people, he said, you know, the Christian myth is so powerful. He said, if you really want to understand Christ's moment on the cross, you have to understand that at that moment, his whole life lived devotedly according to his best understanding. He realized that at that moment it was a terrible illusion.
What?
It was a terrible illusion. That his father had forsaken him, that his cup was not going to pass from him, that he fell and he fell and he fell apart, and he fell into this place. Pardon?
My God, why?
Why hast thou forsaken me? Exactly. And Jung said further, he said, because Jesus had some, he doesn't put it quite this way, but some awareness that there was a bigger story than even he could see, he trusted the process and let go. And that happened to Jung back in 1912. He said, I let myself drop. And his whole life, as he knew it, had just deserted him, and he fell apart. Mark?
Now, I can visualize drop the story. I get that.
Yeah.
What isn't really clear to me is heartbreak. I can cry. I feel. Is there more to heartbreak?
If you can cry and you can feel, you know about heartbreak. Heartbreak is simply a very powerful word, I think, to describe the depth of feeling that's sometimes underneath our neurotic suffering. You know, we go through life miserable. You know, Freud said, my goal is to transform neurotic suffering into everyday misery.
Yeah.
Well, that what he meant was, we all suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, and we cry and we laugh and we go about our business. But those of us who have a trauma history have had to separate from our feelings so radically that when we come back to them, it's a big deal. And things break down that we know. I mean, Daniel Darius in the movie, right? He couldn't cry, he couldn't love, he couldn't feel until he went through very powerful emotions that liquefied it and liquefied his defenses. And then he had Lena to help him, and so he got there. But that, he let his heart break.
But his heart was literally broken.
He had a broken heart physically and literally, didn't he? But his heart broke open because he was able to love them. You can't love with a closed up heart. Yes?
Dropping the story, reality is made through a story. So how do you distinguish who received the story, because if the child received the story, it can be a reality that would be, you will have to educate the child to another reality in order to actually retell the story.
That's
how do you, how do you drop the story to the right person or persona within? If you drop the story, the child is looking for a story at all times, new things, shiny things.
Well, it's a little bit misleading to recommend dropping the story if you have no alternative story.
So how do you distinguish where you drop it?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, Christ on the cross didn't know the next story. Right? But almost all of us need the intimations of a new story before we drop the old one. We need an encouraging person. We need somebody to help us through the process of, you know, we need a guide. We need a Virgil. Don't worry, Dante. It's happened before. It will happen again.
Is that the, this is why I think this is very powerful, is the intervention of what Henry Corbin called the imaginal world,
mm-hmm.
and how it creates a kind of a mediating space for recreation of a world after you've lost one.
Yes.
You know, and I think the great stories of our past, Dante, but also the psyche in its dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where something else can intervene, so it's not just about, you know, heartbreak and loss, but it's the possibility for a new world heretofore unknown.
That's absolutely right, and I appreciate that, Mark.
Yeah.
That's what Jung found out in his act of imagination, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He didn't have a story. He didn't know what lay ahead of him in his discoveries in the Red Book or the Black Book or whatever. So, but he had some faith that the unconscious would help him to reshape, refashion a new story.
Right.
Yes?
Well, along with Mark's name, but more from the energetic perspective, I'm thinking about just my own experience of the last week, and the phrase that came to me
as
I was...
Can you speak up a little bit?
Yes, and I stand up for crying out loud. But anyway, I'm thinking about the quote from the Bible about not being able to put new wine into old wineskins.
Mm-hmm.
There might not be a new story.
Mm-hmm.
There might not be new images. There might not be new intimations, but there's a felt sense that everything you did and were and that fit before does not anymore.
That everything you did and were
what? You did and were and that fit before.
That fit before does no longer
fit. They don't
fits
anymore.
Now.
It's this scratchy, horrible place where nothing is right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just to support that point, this is a modality shift. It's a paradigm shift. Otherwise, bits and pieces of the same menu will not work.
That's right.
That's why in the Bible, Jesus says, I will go and make a home. He didn't say, I will stay and make a home with you. I will make a home and I will come.
Uh-huh.
It's a paradigm shift that is promises a shift that is where there's no participation on the receivers.
And you know, you can't, well, I don't know about making a statement like that. You can't. It's very difficult to do this without another person present.
A witness.
A witness, but also somebody who will hold the space for you while you're gone. You know, oftentimes when you're with a patient who's going through the agonies, you're effectively saying to them, look, I know how painful this is, and but we are holding the space together, and we will hold it together until a new story emerges, until you find out where this is taking you. I can't tell you yet, but I have been there before, and I have every confidence that something new will come out of it. We don't know what that is yet. I had a patient, never forget this example. She is an artist, and she had a great anticipation of seeing me. She had several major dissociative episodes in her life where she lost all track of herself, where she had blank spaces. And she was terrified of that happening again. So she was anxious about coming to therapy and opening up the possibility that she might fall apart again. But she was also excited because she happened to be in graduate school now in clinical psychology, and there were some possibilities that she realized might lead to a future. So she came in to see me, and we talked about her life and her history, and at the end of the hour I asked her, have you had any dreams lately? Because oftentimes when a person is it activates the unconscious.
Right.
So here was her dream. She said, I was in the dress rehearsal for a play that was about to be performed. And this was the night before the first performance. We were in rehearsal. And my role in the play was to go down into the aisles, and there in a bassinet was an 18-month-old baby. And I was to pick up the baby, and when the baby recognized me, the play could go on. So I went down into the aisle, according to my appointed role, and I picked up the baby, and the baby didn't recognize me. And I thought, oh my God, now what? So I went up onto the stage and asked the director, what do I do now? End of dream. Now do you see the wisdom of the unconscious? I mean, the wisdom of the psyche itself was saying to this woman and to me, we better get to know that baby. That child, and I would take this as a symbolic child, not only the orphan child, but the empirical child, symbolic child. That child had information for us that we needed to attend. So a lot of our work has been attending to early unremembered trauma, early unremembered issues, and we've started to uncover some very, very unbearably painful stuff in your childhood. No surprise. Victor?
Right, so this broken heart part that we get in touch with as Jungians is usually from letting go of the left brain and allowing the other, is that
okay? Yeah. Oh. Hold up.
Oneself to feel broken open from a spiritual feeling perspective. But somewhere along the line, what I learned in neurofeedback is that we, maybe with another teacher, midwife, some other has to help us reconnect the left side. Because
yes.
For me, it's the right side that breaks the heart open.
Mm-hmm.
And now I need my left side. And neurofeedback helps that cognitive functioning to come back in such a way that we can plan some sort of rational step. So, you know, probably different for everybody, right? The people who do proprioceptive writing, they listen to their body, and the body will give them a cue to shift. So they shift from the right side to the left side, and then they come out with a nice linear, sequential, logical plan of what happened and what can happen. And to me, it's not surprising why the number one killer is heart disease, is because, you know, we have our heart broken, and we don't make the connection in our body when that occurs to feel the container in the skin that God gave us.
Mm-hmm.
And then to move from that inner child, recognizing this homeostatic principle that's going on inside ourselves, to work our way out and use the tools that are there that we don't have the control.
You know about EMDR, right?
Yeah, right. That's, yeah.
You know the principle of EMDR. Bilateral stimulation, right? So, you know, the way I think about it is that we have affect in the body, and we have images in the mind, and the psyche is constructed. The dream maker gives us affect images that get personified and embedded in a story. That's called a dream. My patient with the rehearsal dream. Okay, the baby was, she felt a lot of feeling when she saw this baby. She also saw the image of the baby. She recognized, oh my God, these are parts of my life that I haven't been well related to. We need to do some work on this. So the image is the rational meaning of the affect. It gives meaning, form. Form-giving component. We need both the left and the right hemisphere. Absolutely. You can't just swim around in the right hemisphere. You know, even no matter what Ian Mavilkas says, you know his work, The Master and His Emissary, he says the right brain, historically in the history of humanity, was the master It's where we came from. We all sang, we all were poets, we all had intuition, we all had synchronicity experiences constantly. And then the left hemisphere took over, and so the master was taken over by the emissary, and now we're in terrible trouble. Look at what we're doing to the planet, for example. So he doesn't have a solution to this. I'm slightly caricaturing him. He's not saying we have to go back to the right brain, but he is saying we have to recover. Ian McGilchrist, The Master and His Emissary. It's a 500-page tome surveying the history of humanity in light of the right and left hemisphere dominance. Alan Shore discovered him and quotes him all the time now, because Alan Shore is very big on the fact that the right hemisphere is the hemisphere that's online in the first 18 months of life, so it's where trauma gets encoded.
The master is very feminine.
I beg your pardon?
The master is very feminine. So
which
man? I mean, part of how we recover. Part of how we recover is we become a post-patriarchal society.
That's right.
The master is feminine.
Yeah. Or has to become more feminine, shall we say?
Balance.
Yeah.
Has to become balanced.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. We're way overbalanced on the figure out.
Yeah,
Leonard Schlein in The Alphabet and the Goddess.
Say again?
Leonard Schlein in The Alphabet and the Goddess felt that we became left brain dominant when we developed reading, and reading became, the more universal reading became, the more we lost our connection to the right brain. But it's...
Blaming that on reading. I don't
know.
Because I think reading also introduces us to the right brain.
It's a linear function,
right.
But
yeah.
He says we're reintroduced to the right brain through images,
mm-hmm.
Pictures and motion pictures.
Okay.
It certainly is a patriarchal intervention into through text.
Yeah.
Well, images that had nothing to do with what they were. You know,
right.
The shape of something means this.
Yeah. Okay. We're I think we're on the same page with this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like to cut off the conversation, but I do want to get through this. Okay. So, because I promised that I would get through this.
We are in hell, and we're keeping you here for
us. That's right. Okay. Now, I was saying that. Now this is the event that that Virgil is telling. When I was newly in this state, I saw one come in majesty and awe. This is the so-called harrowing of hell, and if you want to look this up on, you know, now you can look it up on Google, and you can find all kinds of amazing images. Here you see Christ bearing the cross, reaching out for Adam. Eve is on the left, and the crypt of limbo and hell is beneath, with all the locks and the doors having been broken. There are many images of this moment. Here's another one where most of these images, you see the devil down here looking very put out. Very few of these images show children being rescued, but that's implicit in all of them. So it's whatever's been captured and caught and imprisoned in Hades is now being rescued. Now there's hell represented by a monstrous animal. The following passage that I want to read you is from the Easter Eve homily of Epiphanius, and describes Christ rescuing Adam, who is the aboriginal form or image of humankind, at least one half of it. And as you listen to this archaic language, remember that this passage is about the resolution of a defense and the restoration of an aboriginal part of ourselves that's been lost. So here's the language. The Lord entered, bearing the conquering weapon of the cross. Adam trembled. and taking his hand, Christ raised him, saying, "Awake, O sleeping one, and rise from the dead, and Christ shall give thee light. Arise, O sleeping one, arise, for I did not make thee to be bound in Hades. Arise from the dead, I am the life of the dead. Arise, my image, arise, my form, who was made in my image. Arise, let us go hence, for thou art in me, and I am in thee, and in undivided person